The Bilateral Banking System 2.0, July 11, 2021, by Justice Anna Von Wrights, Big Lake, Alaska. In these first forays into the actual topic, it is important to establish the history and background for the discussion, because much of this is unknown to the man on the street and is fundamental to an understanding of how we got into this mess in the first place. The concept of money, that is, that a coin could stand for a bushel of wheat or a bale of cotton, started in Babylon thousands of years ago. This was initially a token system. The Queen of Babylon basically said, instead of moving bushels of wheat and bales of cotton around, we are going to use these little round pieces of metal stamped with an image of wheat baskets or cotton balls to represent these things. And by royal decree, these coins will entitle the bearer to either a bushel of wheat or a bale of cotton from our storehouses. One wheat coin equals one bushel of wheat. One cotton coin equals one bale of cotton. So it began. Such token systems are still in use today, though we use paper receipts called coupons and vouchers instead of coins stamped with an image of the commodity. Such systems maintain a direct relationship of the token to the item specified. A coupon giving you a dollar off the price of a 3-pound can of Folgers brand coffee can't be cashed in against a 3-pound can of Kirkland brand coffee. A voucher issued during World War II for a pound of butter was good for a pound of butter regardless of brand name or source, but was still only good for a pound of butter, and the butter was doled out at a requisition center run by the military to make sure that the butter vouchers were being matched up with butter in the correct quantities. The problem with such systems, despite their item-by-item utility, is that you have to have a separate coin, a coupon, a voucher, etc., standing for each and every item, Folgers coffee, or class of items, butter. At the dawn of the modern era, this specificity of tokens became a real pain in the butt for certain international merchants in the city of Venice. Unlike former eras when an olive oil merchant was an olive oil merchant, the merchants of Venice were trading in hundreds of different commodities arriving daily from around the world. What to do? Issue coins or separate printed receipts for bolts of silk from China, nutmeg from India, salt from Switzerland, and so on? And then, once these coins made it back to the warehouse, how to guarantee a match-up between the coin and the goods that coin was issued against? Perishable items were especially difficult to deal with in a token system, and, given the increasing distance between active trading centers, Venice was now trading with Hamburg and Moscow, not just local trade centers in the Mediterranean. The time between issuance of a token for butter and collection of the butter by a buyer could be months instead of days. This required the merchant to always have a considerable storage of any given commodity on hand to back any run on that commodity by the token holders. This is exactly similar to what happens with a bank run today, only instead of people all trying to get cash out of the bank on the same day and potentially exhausting the bank's cash supplies, the merchants of Venice faced this same dilemma with dozens of commodities, all of which had to be warehoused and stored against such an eventuality. Then one day, Don Giovanni di Marcos, note the name, had a brilliant idea. Instead of issuing all these specific tokens against specific commodities, why not issue non-specific tokens, all based on the value of a standard commodity like gold? The modern concept of money was born. Soon, the merchants of Venice were heaving a sigh of relief. Not only were people accepting the gold coins in exchange for goods in general, they were accepting them in exchange for services as well. Soon, producing the gold coins stamped with the City of Venice coat of arms became a whole separate business. In fact, there was such demand for this new commodity that the price of gold was forced upward, simply because gold was used to make the coins. Other cities and royal houses quickly joined the bandwagon and began issuing their own coinage, stamped with their particular maker's marks. These currencies soon acquired their own brand names: the Spanish dollar, the Portuguese real, the German-Swiss-French francs, the Polish kroner, the British pound sterling, and so on, were all born in short order, and entered the money market as competitive commodities. Currencies differed not only in content, gold or silver, but in quality, purity of gold or silver, and consistency, Could you count on the content and purity? And buying power. A mythos soon attached to each brand, and competitive elements beyond just the content and purity of physical metal entered into it, similar to the eternal battles between Pepsi and Coke, Nike and Converse, John Deere and International Harvester, the American dollar against the French franc, and so on. As the years have gone on and the distance between trading centers has continued to increase until every mom and pop store on the planet is connected potentially to every other store via the mail and other transport systems, currencies have become more and more symbolic, changing form from actual precious metal to certificates representing precious metals to promissory notes representing indebtedness to digits on a ledger. This is, of course, all increasingly arbitrary and increasingly detached from physical reality. And therein lies the rub. Back in Babylon, there was a one-to-one relationship between a bushel of wheat in a warehouse and a little gold coin stamped with a picture of a bushel of wheat. Now there is no necessary connection between a piece of paper called a dollar or a ruble and any physical commodity at all, much less any consideration of the purity and content of any physical commodity. The American silver dollar is still a 1 ounce coin of stamped fine silver, but the USD is a piece of paper issued by commercial subcontractors of the American government as a debt note against their employers, purportedly for unpaid services rendered. These pikers have built up an astronomical claim of debt against their employers, simply by not allowing their employers to offset this debt against what the federal subcontractors owe in return. Such offset was guaranteed under the National Emergency Banking Act of 1934 and defined as a mutual offset credit exchange exemption, which the same villains have avoided paying all these years by a simple crime of impersonation and false registration of their American employers as British territorial U.S. citizens and dual municipal citizens of the United States, too. What, you may ask, is a moshi? It's what happens when two people owe each other debts, and swap the debts. You owe me $100. I owe you $10. So, instead of paying you, I say, okay, now you only owe me $90. That's a moshi, and that option of paying public debts is what Americans have been owed since 1934. The essence of the crime against the American people is to deny them their offset credit option based on the self-interested and fraudulent legal presumption that all the Americans chose en masse to become British subjects, and therefore are owed no mutual offset credit exchange exemption. We are here to tell you that no, we are all still Americans, we are owed our mutual offset credit exchange exemptions, and no, we didn't magically become British territorial citizens simply because the Queen's flunkies went around the country misidentifying and secretively registering us as such, while on our payroll. Not only do we not owe $25 trillion of debt to the British Crown Corp and the Pope, but they owe us a vast deal more than that, even after we offset that entire amount. According to the books kept on this subject, and just as an example, they owe me, personally, slightly more than $12 billion of credit, compared to $50 million of debt. And that is without arguing the details. So, who is the priority creditor and who is the actual debtor? The entire British Empire and the Holy See are the debtors, and the Americans are the creditors who have been cheated out of their remedy and extorted to extend infinite credit to these same criminal elements. This is the filthy dishonorable trick that the Holy See and the British Crown and the British government in sum total, have played on their loyal allies, the Americans. They couldn't even be decent enough to provide the mutual offset credit exchange exemption they promised as the remedy for their theft of our gold, silver, labor, land, and other assets taken illegally and managed for us under their custodianship. Faced with the bill for all this fraud and crime, all they could come up with was an insurance fraud scheme to cash in on the life insurance policies they took out on all of us, to the tune of $950 trillion of profit as life force value annuities paid out to Prince Philip by the Governor of Ottawa in April of 2017, and, for which, they presumably guaranteed to kill us, their priority creditors, all according to Prince Philip's stated wish, to become a loathsome virus after his death and kill off most of the human race. He got his wish, so far. The Peer Bright Institute owns the patent. pay attention, in April 2017, Prince Philip collected the insurance scam money, $950 trillion in life force value annuities, and this year the old scratch finally, officially, died, though we don't necessarily believe that, and, like magic, millions of Americans and Europeans are being vaccinated against a loathsome virus that, curiously, has never been isolated. But, heads up to the insurance companies worldwide. We aren't the only ones being destroyed and bilked for these crimes. You are, too. And, heads up to the rest of the people in this world. We aren't the only ones who stand to take it in the shorts for these criminals. You are, too. Everything that goes around, comes around. We weren't swift enough to realize that instead of abolishing slavery, the vermin institutionalized it via the bogus 14th Amendment included in their corporation's disguise charter, named after the Constitution of the United States of America. The so-called Negro citizenship was eventually, and with malice, secretively applied to every American by these international criminals, and so, by legal fiat and sleight of hand, they have milked and bilked and now propose to use medicine and patents and insurance fraud as a means to profit themselves via the deaths of their priority creditors. It's important for the rest of the world to note that you are all next on their platter, especially the Chinese. See this article and over 3,200 others on Anavon Wright's website. Support Anna's work using PayPal donation. Remedy. Find out how to stop the plunder, robbery, and piracy. If you really are serious about knowing how to restore the republic and your freedom, you need to put some effort into knowing how our freedoms are being robbed from us by fraud, lack of full disclosure, deception, threat, duress, coercion, and intimidation every day of our lives and have been for over 100 years by the criminals who have hijacked our government, wealth, and heritage for their own gain and evil intentions. Are you really required to file a 1040 income tax form with the IRS? Are you really required to obey draconian codes and statutes issued by the so-called federal government? At Anavon Wright's website you will learn precisely how Americans have been press-ganged into the foreign international jurisdiction of the sea and have as a result been attached, attacked, and deprived of their rights and property under conditions of fraud, semantic deceit, and non-disclosure. At the American States Assembly you will learn the lawful remedies for these problems and crimes committed against Americans. Remember, there is no statute of limitations against the crime of fraud, and that fraud destroys any contract that it touches.